My castaway this week is an opera singer. You may never have heard of her. She's opera's forgotten voice, which today, thanks to the release of some previously unknown recordings, has reached a large new audience of admirers. Now 80, she was born in Russia just before the revolution. She's known poverty and hardship as well as some success. She's sung with Gigli, Gobbi and Bergonzi and been abandoned by lovers and managers alike. But her voice has stayed with her. How is it possible, asked one reviewer after her first CD was recently released, that such a singer has not come down as one of the century's most celebrated sopranos? She is Kira Vane. The reception of these recordings has been ecstatic, Kira. Why isn't she a superstar, another critic asks. It must be a very bittersweet experience for you.
It is, totally.
Can you accept it?
It's been difficult, very, very difficult, but I have accepted it now. I'm fine now. I'm enjoying it.
But it's been quite an emotional business
for you, tremendous,
hasn't it?
Tremendous. I mean, when the CD, the project started, I was panic-stricken and I begged the powers that be not to do it because I thought I would be ridiculed, I thought my voice would be torn to shreds and the CDs would gather dust. And then one by one the reviews came and they were all unanimous and I spent my time having hysterics.
But what they can't understand, the question that keeps being asked is why was this voice, which is obviously one of the greats, another one has said, why was it ignored, why was it never recorded? What's the answer to that question?
Well, bad management, I think, A, and lack of perception, I think, from the point of view of agents and the establishment.
It's interesting because some of the experts who are now wondering why you weren't recognised before have said that perhaps it was not ineffective management, that it was you who perhaps lacked the drive and the ambition to get there.
It is possible. I was not an aggressive person. It is totally not in my nature to ever ask for favours. Because to me, that is being beholden, and I just cannot be beholden.
So, therefore, what happened was that these recordings, some of which were made, I think, non-professionally, weren't they?
Oh, yes, they were all. They were all either taped from the BBC or from Scandinavia, where I sang, or some of them I did, like the Im Frühling by Schubert, I did just curiosity to hear my voice.
So that those recordings have spent the last 30 years underneath your bed in Shepherd's Bush?
Literally. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. While you worked in a branch of Barclays Bank?
Well, I've worked in many, many places. I also worked for the BBC as a secretary.
So you definitely want to take one or two of these recordings of yours to your desert island, I'm sure. Tell me about the first one.
Tatiana? Well, I think Tatiana, for me, I suppose, was always an ambitious thing because she is the epitome of the Russian maiden of that class.
And she's the heroine of Tchaikovsky's
Eugene Onegin. She's the heroine
of
Eugene Onegin. And somehow, I think, in a way, possibly my character was similar to hers.
Part of Tatiana's letter scene from Tchaikovsky's Eugene Onegin, sung by my castaway Kira Vane. You did rise, obviously, very high in your profession. You shared the limelight, as I mentioned, in your time with the likes of Gobbi and Gigli and Taliviani. Some of them were not great sharers, by all accounts. One of them undid the back of your dress, apparently.
Yeah, that happened to me twice. One tenor and one baritone. Tagliavini, in our love scene at in the third act, he sort of threw me over his knee.
This is Tosca.
Tosca, and I had a cape over it, and he just simply went behind my cape and just undid all my hooks and eyes, right down to my knees, literally. And when I had to throw the cloak at Spoleto, the villain, before I jump into the river, I was more or less nude. I had to clutch the back of my dress.
But why did he do it? It surely destroyed the performance.
No, because I camouflaged it. But pure jealousy, because to them, they are the only thing that matters.
What about Gobbi, Tito Gobbi? He apparently got very rough with you. He was playing Scarpia, wasn't he?
Gobbi didn't want to rehearse at all. I mean, they didn't rehearse. So he assumed that as I was a beginner, he'd better sort of hypnotise me into doing what he wanted to do, so that everything I had studied with various directors and people like Maria Kuznetsova just went for Burton, because he literally forced me, standing with his back to the audience, forced me hypnotically to get up, to sit down, to go left, to go right. And then just before my aria, when he throws himself at me, I mean, he nearly asphyxiated me, and I swallowed an ostrich feather, which was a resplendent collar on my dress, and that was it.
What, so you couldn't sing because there was a feather in your throat?
I couldn't start because there is no overture to the aria. It just sort of goes ping and you sing. And I just couldn't. The feather was right across my larynx. After two or three notes, it sort of worked itself clear. But I mean, as far as the audience was concerned, and Webster, who was in the audience, and the media, it was stage fright.
Who was Webster?
Webster was head of Covent Garden.
So you didn't get invited to Covent Garden?
So I didn't get invited to Covent Garden.
But you're saying the motive for all of this was jealousy?
Well, it must be jealousy. What else can it be? I mean, instead of helping somebody who was singing a debut, as I would and as I did, they wanted to destroy.
So the Knight of the Feather was your debut as Tosca, was it?
That's right, that was my debut.
So it was really a devastating moment in your career.
Oh, it was shattering, absolutely shattering. And our PR, who should have told the media, didn't. But the next morning, the headlines were Rigoletto tenor in Covent Garden swallows his moustache. And that was Walter Mitchelly, who that same night had swallowed his moustache. He got the headlines, and I got the slating criticisms.
Tell me about your second record.
My second record. Well, my mother was a very, very brilliant amateur pianist, very brilliant, and she was specifically good in Chopin, so I was sort of brought up on it. And whenever I hear Chopin, she becomes three-dimensional, so I'd like to have that.
Part of Chopin's Prelude in D-flat, Opus 28, Raindrop, played by Artur Rubinstein, and memories, Kira Vane, of your mother, from whom you obviously inherit your musical talent. She was a piano teacher whose work saved you from starvation for some years, didn't it?
Well, she wasn't a teacher as such. She became a teacher because that was her only way of earning the odd crust.
But how close were you to starving?
Pretty close. I mean, you know, there were times when we ate potato peels in water, and rotten fish bones would be for Sunday.
This was just after the revolution.
This was after the revolution.
Because you were born just before it.
I was born in 16, 18 months before the revolution.
And you were really quite a well-off family, weren't you, in St. Petersburg?
We came from a good background, yes.
So what happened? Why did you end up eating potato peelings?
Because we had run away from St. Petersburg, because that was where the revolution was taking part, so to speak, and we squatted all the way down to the Black Sea.
Had you taken any of your possessions with you?
The only possession that we took, and I shall never know why, was a wonderful full-length caracule coat of my mother's, black caracule, which in the end she bartered for a reel of white cotton, because everything was in rags and cotton was at its premium.
And you would have been very, very tiny. How aware were you of what was going on?
I wasn't tremendously aware, except that there was a tremendous tension, and one knew that one was in the middle of something that could blow up at any moment. I mean, one had enemies in front, behind and around one.
Because the family went back to St. Petersburg, didn't it?
We did, but after quite a time. My father went back first to try and find work, and we stayed outside Moscow, and that was where we ate very, very badly.
And then eventually back to St. Petersburg. Did you know fear as a child? Did you understand?
I think as long as my mother was with me, I knew no fear. It's very strange, but to me she was... Well, she was my security. That was why when she went to her lessons, it was shattering for me, because I would be left waiting for her to come back, and I would just stand on one spot waiting for her.
So you would have been, during all of this time, 3, 4, 5, 6?
That's right. I returned back to St. Petersburg, well, to Leningrad, when I was about 5, 5 and a half. And then when I was 8, we came to England.
And the family arrived in London, literally, in the clothes.
In the clothes we stood in, absolutely. My father did come to a job, because as a young man he had worked for a private bank in the city, and so very fortunately they accepted him again. And he had a very good job, but in 1929, with the American crash, the bank went bankrupt, and that was it.
But you personally, presumably, could speak not a word of English.
When I came, I didn't speak a word.
Aged 8.
Yeah.
Tell me about record number 3.
Record number 3. Schalappen has always been sort of a background to my childhood. I mean, he was a godlike figure. And so I would have to have him on the island. And so I've chosen Mussorgsky's Trepak.
Тем лучше мужика смерть обнимает, ласкает с пьяненьким стажем в моем трепака. Но ухо петь напевает. Ой, мужичок, старичок счастливый, пьяный пился, попился дорог. О, метелька, ведьма поднялась, играла с полем лезли, пути невзначай загнала. Горем, тоской, дружной томим, лег при корниду с неродимый. Я тебя, голубчик мой, снежком согрей, круг тебя великую игру затей.
Schalappen singing Mussorgsky's Trepak, number 1 of Songs and Dances of Death. At what point, Kira Vane, were you aware that you had an exceptional voice?
I suppose around about 12-ish, 14. I just used to hum and sing Russian folk songs.
But did you start having lessons?
I started when I was about 18.
And who paid?
My father paid until I was 19 and then told me I was on my own, and I paid from then onwards. Don't ask me how. I've never understood.
I read that you paid with your wages from some rather shady reviews you did.
Well, my very, very first show was with a man called Ernie Lottinger, who was a brilliant comic, but the lower echelon, I would say.
So what went on in these shows then?
Well, we had Phyllis Dixie, if you remember her at all. She was the first stripper. She was a very pristine-looking, gorgeous woman, but she very genteelly used to strip. I was a showgirl. I mean,
what did that mean? What did it entail?
One just sort of came on and off singing rather stupid songs.
Like what?
I can't remember them.
But you didn't take your clothes off.
Oh, no, no. Oh, God, no.
But apparently at some point you won a Golden Voice competition in Clapham.
When I was 18, the very, very first vocal competition, I think, ever, was born in England. And I applied, won all the heats, until I reached the heights of Clapham. And I became the Golden Voice Girl of Clapham. And then a gentleman from Chappell's Publishing rang me and said, did I want to win the prize? And I thought, well, yes, rather nice. So he said, would I have lunch with him? And of course one realised what that really meant, and my father simply forbade me to go. But obviously that was the way things worked even then.
Well, that was the way people got on.
Well, they obviously heard my potential. They would have made the heats. I mean, they would have somehow contrived them.
But you were obviously very vulnerable. You were a beautiful young foreigner, and there were men out there who were eager to take advantage of you.
And women.
Really?
Oh, gosh, yes. Oh, dear, yes.
In what way?
Well, I mean, there were ladies who fancied me.
So you were propositioned by women as well as men?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. But, I mean, I took that lightly, because in those days one didn't really recognise that side of it as being sort of concrete, you know. It was a little bit beyond my understanding, really.
So did you always manage to resist in the end?
Yes, I did. I chose my own lovers, or whatever you might call them, usually appalling, but never, except for my impresario, did I have anybody who was of any use to me.
And I want to ask you about him in a moment, but let's pause there for record number four.
Well, when I was doing ENSA, there was a wonderful young man called Timothy Lloyd. He was wonderfully good-looking. He was 18, the most fascinating sense of humour. And he made his own puppets and presented these puppets, Francis Daimler and Dietrich, Carol Gibbons, Evelyn Lay, and worked them himself on the stage with their records. And somehow, Francis Day singing I la 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 love you so and then I need you so became our song, and he used to often come and visit me in my flat during the war when there was a blackout, and also we had an awful lot of pea soup fogs. You literally could not see your hand in front of your face. And so he could have lost direction. I used to go outside and wait for him, and I could hear far, far away him whistling this, I love you so. So I would shout, and then he'd come running.
I need you so, I love you so, I do. I love you so, I need you so, I will want to know if you love me too as much as I love you. I did a dream that we could closely be together all night through. I put the proudly own the bungalow for two.
Francis Day singing I Lulla Love You So. And what happened to Timothy Lloyd, who came through the pea soupers to you?
He was killed in Italy when he was 22.
What, in the middle of the war?
Yes. He was an officer.
Now, you did succumb to the advances just after the war, I think, both professional and personal, of one Eugene Iskoldov.
That's right, my impresario.
Now, it seems to me he had two problems, because he wasn't very musical and he was married.
Yes, the latter didn't really function very much, because he wasn't happily married, and she was in Paris.
And were you very much in love?
No, I was never in love with him. I left home because my father had insulted me rather, and I left home, and he was the only person I could go to, and he had been wanting to give me a career for years, and I thought that this was the logical.
But he wasn't very musical, so how did
he know? He wasn't musical. He had what is called the, in German, it's called Fingerspitzengefühle. It's the instinct, you know, the gut feeling of whether somebody has talent or not. I mean, he had his own ballet company and things like that. He was Schaleppin's impresario for quite a time. But his great failing was that he loved himself above anything else and always wanted his name on top of any bill. He got me contracts, for instance, like Liceo Barcelona and other places, but he was never, ever there to see them carried through, so that he was never there to sign a contract for the next season.
But now, how did you know what you were doing? I mean, beyond having had these singing lessons, how did you know about opera? How did you know how to sing? How did you develop your technique?
Through experience and through, I think, tremendous instinct.
Can you describe your voice to me, what kind of voice you had?
It's very difficult. I think it's an exquisitely beautiful voice with no faults to it. I mean, now I listen to it objectively. And I think it had an amazing coloration. I think that I paint the words and give enormous emotional feeling without ever affecting the tonal quality. I think I was born with a natural voice which was naturally placed already. Some voices are not placed. They have to be placed.
So obviously, in your view, some people listening to you might say that sounds rather immodest to say you had this perfect voice, but what you're saying is it was a gift.
Oh, it was a total gift, and it's not immodesty, because I'm totally objective. I listen to my voice as not belonging to me. I mean, after a span of 40 years, can you imagine?
Tell me about your next record.
My next record is Kira Vane singing Yaroslavna's Complaint from Prince Igor. I sang the two Yaroslavna arias as an audition piece for the Liceo Barcelona. I just sang them onto a tape and they were sent there and I got the job.
My castaway, Kira Vane, singing Yaroslavna's Complaint from Borodin's Prince Igor. Now, you were 41, I think, when your agent finally hit financial disaster and indeed committed suicide. This seems to have had a tremendous effect on you, because you just decided to give up, didn't you?
Well, I was penniless. I had refused any salary for a year to help him financially, and I had pawned everything I possessed. And I was never able to bail the things out.
But you still had a piano, didn't you?
I had an upright piano, yes.
But
Why did you say that?
Because you decided to give that away.
Well, I gave everything away. Eventually, after about 3 years, I gave everything away. I couldn't bear to have any mementos at all.
Because of everything that might have been?
Well, because of everything that might have been, everything that I still had to give.
So you... Did you almost feel suicidal yourself at this point?
Oh, very much, except that I don't think that that is a solution. I don't think suicide is a solution at all.
So you threw everything out, turned your back on your old life, and went to work in a bank?
Well, I went to work secretarially. I mean, I worked in banks, but I started as a temp and then became permanent, but I never kept the job for long.
How much did you tell your colleagues about your colourful past?
Very little.
They had no idea what you'd done before?
No, no.
What do you think they made of you?
They must have thought I was an oddball, I suppose.
Almost like leading a double life, really. To put all that behind you and then go out and present yourself as an ordinary person who'd never stood on a stage, never known the possibility of any fame.
It's possible. I mean, I did it. I did. I became a nonentity. That is why accepting what has happened now has been so difficult. Because a lot of my personal friends didn't know I sang. Great friends that I've had for 40 years, you know. I mean, they knew I sang vaguely, but they had no conception of what a career I had had.
But it must take enormous self-control to keep that a secret through all those years and through close friendships.
It came naturally because for 10 years I lived through hell. And then little by little you became a normal person. You lived a normal life. I had lovely friends. I always entertained. And that was forgotten.
So now you're out of the closet, you're exposed.
I'm exposed, totally. And people ask me, why? What's so special about your voice? I don't know, it's the same as it was, isn't it?
Tell me about record number six.
Number six is, Rosa Bonsell was always a tremendous inspiration to me because I think our voices were very, very similar and she was always there for me as an example of beautiful singing. So this is the Casta Diva from Norma.
Rosa Bonsell singing the aria Casta Diva from Bellini's Norma with the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra conducted by Giulio Setti, and that was recorded in 1929, one of your great inspirations.
Definitely, yes.
What was your last professional performance? Can you remember?
Yes, it was a very big Russian recital for the BBC.
Where?
Broadcasting House.
In this very building,
yes.
Is it? And that was then the offers dried
up. That was 65. And it's singing at my best.
And in hindsight, do you think you made the right decision in the end in turning your back on it all? Did you find peace of mind?
I found peace of mind after about 10 years, yes. But no, I shouldn't have given it up.
It's a terribly sad story, your life, of tragedy and misfortune and unhappy accident, isn't it?
I'm Russian, aren't I?
Is that what it is?
I suppose. I think that somebody with a special talent has a special character, really. I mean, either you're incredibly ambitious and aggressive, or you value your talent to such an extent that you wouldn't allow anyone to pollute it. Does that make sense?
Yes, it also means, I think everything one's learned about you, means that you are naturally of a very dramatic persona yourself, aren't you?
Oh, I think so, yes. I'm very, very emotional, tremendously emotional. And I also have a very strong sense of responsibility towards people. I mean, anyone in trouble or anything, I always take on, you know. That's why I remained loyal to people to whom I shouldn't have done.
Which was part of your problem all along.
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely.
Tell me about your next piece of music.
My next piece of music is myself singing Im Frühling by Schubert. I did that as a one-off just to hear what my voice sounded like when I was in my late 20s. And I never, ever dreamt that it would be of such importance on a CD.
Is it die an des Hügels an der Himmel ist so klar? Das Lüften spielt im grünen Tal, wo ich beim ersten Frühling strahl. Mein Star so glücklich war, so glücklich war. Wo ich an ihrer Seite ging, so traulich und so nah, und tief im dunklen Felsen grell, den schönen Himmel blau und hell, und sie im Himmel sah, und sie im Himmel sah.
Kira Vain singing Schubert's Im Frühling. So here you are, being acclaimed at last. I can imagine that the last thing you want to have happen is to be sent to a desert island.
That's right. You're absolutely right.
But in a sense, of course, professionally speaking, at least you've been on one for the last 30 years, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I never thought of that. Yes, you're right.
But now it's all coming together again.
It's come back. I mean, it's a prophecy that was made about 34 years ago, word for word. I was in the middle of a relationship that had gone sour, and somebody said, why don't you call this woman? She's awfully good. She advises you. Clairvoyant. So I did. I didn't know her from Adam. She didn't know who I was. She came. She told me the present situation, and word for word, she told me what was going to happen with this man, which did happen. And as she was leaving by the front door, she suddenly sort of got a lack of expression on her face, and in a very mechanical way said, when you're at the end of your life and your voice is a memory and your career non-existent, your voice will be reborn. And I always remembered this and thought that it was spiritual, that I thought that when one dies, one's soul perhaps, you know, proclaims or burst into song. That's how I thought. And when this actually started happening, it was really very weird.
Last record.
Well, this is Beethoven's Symphony No. 9, because to me it's always been tremendously elemental, and I feel it on an island when one is at the mercy of the elements and surrounded by them. This would be something apt, and it's beautifully long too.
Part of the final movement of Beethoven's Symphony No. 9, played by the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Wilhelm Furtwängler. If you could only take one of those records, Kira, which one of the eight would it be?
The Beethoven.
Because it's long.
Yes.
Not yourself.
No. No, I can always do a few scales.
What about your book? What would you like?
My
book?
I would love an imaginative cookery book that would make one feel as if one had had a good meal.
And what about your luxury?
My luxury would be some sort of animal food which would tame the little four-legged ones and the birds. I wouldn't be allowed to take my own cat, would I?
I'm sorry, no.
No, I know. So I've prepared myself for that. I am mad about animals, and I couldn't live without animals.
Keira Vane, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much. I feel it's an enormous achievement.